The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What did the term make love mean in the 19th century?
It meant be affectionate and loving, usually in a close proximity with, you know, with your lover. Didn't necessarily mean having sex. So the way I've read it in numerous novels, you could sit down next to a woman at a party and make love to her by speaking in an intimate way. And so that's Janine's understanding of making love to somebody in the 19th century.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. My guest this time is David Allen Cates, and we're talking about his latest novel, Tom Connor's Gift. Do you remember where the idea for this book came from?
The idea developed during the process of writing it, but I did begin this book in a very deliberate way. It had been a year since a novel of mine called Freeman Walker had come out. I hadn't done a lot of writing, and I had a real urge to begin another novel. I didn't know what it was going to be about, but I thought, if I go away to this cabin that a friend of mine had in the Sun River Canyon, that I could get a start on something, and that I could then come back and work on it. I've always been a guy who's fit my writing into my family life and never really felt like I had to go away to write, but I just had to break the inertia. So I went there, and I brought with me a bunch of letters from an old friend of mine who'd killed himself. It had been like 9 months before. So I had a sense that there was something of the past that I wanted to kind of look at. I also had an idea that I had in my mind. I wanted to write just a long love story, a story about love over decades. My other books had been very controlled in their prose, short paragraphs, very precise sentences, and I wanted to write something that was more like a blast, in which the prose was wide open and shooting out of a hose. And so I had those things in my head. My parents were failing with Alzheimer's. There'd been a long grieving process with that. I think I had a lot of grief in me, so I wrote a grief novel. But I didn't have that when I went. I thought I could write a grief novel. What I wanted to write was a story about a long love. And this book is a story about two long loves. So in that sense, I had that intention, and that's what happened. But I didn't know I was going to write from a middle-aged widow's perspective. That emerged in that first chapter. I came back from that cabin with a chapter written by a 49-year-old widow, doctor, self-exiled in this cabin on the eastern front of the Rocky Mountains. And I swallowed hard, and I thought, oh, my God, what am I getting myself into here? But it was very compelling to me, and it felt like I'd put a character on the edge and there was a novel out there in front of her.
Besides Janine, who's the 49-year-old widow, the main characters in Tom Connor's Gift are her husband, Mark, a former boyfriend, Tom, and a bear and a puppy. So just tell us a little bit about what's going on with everybody when the novel begins.
Well, Janine's husband, Mark, has died 6 months before, and she's from Wisconsin. And from the time she was very young, she's been engaged in a process of becoming a doctor and then becoming a mother at a very early age. And so she's been in the groove step after step after step her whole life, trying to keep it together. Once her husband dies, she continues to try to keep it together. This all happens before the book starts. But the book is when it all breaks apart. She's no longer that person who puts left foot in front of right and moves forward down the trail. She's now off the trail, both psychologically and geographically. And she thinks about her long marriage with her husband, Mark, who's a rancher and a woodworker. And she also brings with her these letters that a a man named Tom Connor had sent her from the time she was about 17 until the time she was about 31. And he and she had run away from home, crossed the plains to Montana when she was 16. She fell in love with him. He disappeared, went down to Central America. She went home, finished high school, went to college, went to med school, got married, had children. In the meantime, she was getting these letters from Tom Connor, and they were letters from the other side, in a sense. He was down in Central America. He was well off the trail. And he shared with her his struggles and his adventures in a very intimate way over those years. They weren't letters in which he was trying to woo her, although he could have, because at first when he was gone, she loved him very much. But they were letters in which he was giving something of himself to her. But yet, while she was receiving them, when she was a young woman, she didn't understand them. She thought they were weird. They came from some other place. Tom was in kind of a nutball. And it's only now in her grief and in her lostness that she's able to understand them and absorb them and see the gift that they were to her.
Let's hear you read a few paragraphs from the novel, but first explain why Janine has furniture pushed up against the door in the cabin.
She, the first scene, she sees a bear outside the cabin. It's early in the morning, and she gets back inside the cabin, but she pushes the door closed, and it breaks. The hinge comes out of the wall. So then she pushes a bunch of furniture up against this broken door to keep the bear out. This is the back door of the cabin. And it's kind of an absurd notion that that's going to keep the bear out, but what else are you going to do with a broken door? And it's part of the general chaos that the cabin becomes over the course of the 3 weeks of the novel. It's after lunch and after a nap, and I've gotten out the shoebox and pushed aside the mess on the table and set it down. Just opening the box and looking at all of the letters in their different colored airmail envelopes makes me begin to panic. That and the wind that again rattles the back door and the stool wedged under the knob. I get up and slide a big stuffed chair from the living room through the kitchen and up against the door. Then I finger the ragged wood on the molding where the screws have pulled out, pick up the bag of spackle and read the directions. Just add water, like pancake mix. So I get a little jar and mix the white powder with the water and spread it over the soft place in the wood where the top hinge was connected to the door frame. I do it with a spoon. It looks solid and smooth, and when I finish, I'm briefly pleased with myself. I go back to the table and the letters, but my heart starts beating faster, and I decide that before I begin reading, I'm going to put them in order. I want to read them like that, as I receive them, as they were written. But the tactic also helps me delay. The first week here, I took long walks and read crappy novels. The second week, I hung out at the Canyon Lodge and drank too much wine and ate too many bad salads and good steaks. And this third week, I've been a little sick with a virus, my throat scratchy, and I picked up this mutt puppy that I haven't even named yet from a woman giving them away outside the grocery store in town. It's not that I'm dreading reading the letters. I'm dreading being finished with them. Reading them has been my purpose for weeks, and after I've done it, I'm afraid I won't have anything to do or any reason to do it. I keep imagining reading them and then just staring out the window, thinking about Tommy and his tragic story, and feeling only worse, more empty and alone than I feel already, and with nothing particular to do. We can endure loneliness and emptiness as long as we have things we have to do, work to do, children to clothe and feed, that sort of thing. The cabin where I'm staying is an old friend's, and she and her husband never use it, so it's mine, really, for as long as I want it. And reading these letters is the only thing on my schedule. The word makes me laugh. How odd not to be busy. How unnatural it feels. For years, my life was a schedule I was perpetually behind on. My husband waited for me. My children waited for me. The hospital built a waiting room for all the patients who waited for me. I could go back to work, and I want to be able to go home. But even the thought of being back at the farm on Thanksgiving 3.5 weeks from now freezes my insides. I suggested to the twins that we meet at some other place, but they wouldn't have it. They want to tie this loss their feeling to something real, to the farm at Thanksgiving without their father. But I'm far from convinced I'm going to do that. I'd meet them anywhere else in the world. I calculate my savings plus the value of the farm if I were to sell it, and the doors of the world start to swing open, all of them leading to strange and ridiculous rooms. I could go north to Canada and ski at Banff for the winter, or south to Chile again and eat grapes, or Antarctica. When I think of those places, I think of snapshots of me in those places. Not really being there, just being seen there, just having proof that I was there by myself or with fun people I meet and that I never see again. My life no longer a schedule, but a series of albums posted on Facebook. My mind blows with ideas, all of them mildly amusing and equally empty. I could go to England or Spain or China. Why not? I have literally no obligations. I could help my son with med school, and still I'd have enough money to take cooking classes in Paris for a few years. I could take trains and ships around the world numerous times. I could take a riverboat down the Amazon, ride a horse across Mongolia. I could make these adventures as dangerous or exotic as I wanted. I could get in shape and climb Everest. The variety of things I could do is staggering, but at the moment they all feel equally empty and sad. My mind rebels against such a concept that the world could offer so little. Poor little rich girl. It's pathetic and makes me angry at Mark for taking everything with him. Ah, love, he'd say, quoting his favorite poem, let us be true to one another, even when he wasn't always. And then he died, like the period at the end of a novel, only a blank page to follow. Ugh, now what? Has the world really neither joy nor light nor love nor peace nor certitude nor help for pain? What a bastard that he could die and take all those things away, even my desire to see our children at Thanksgiving. And what a fool I was to think, when he asked me if it all goes away, everything, that he was talking about himself.
There are a few moments in this book where she kind of loses her grip on reality and starts seeing Mark in the bear's face and the bear's face in Mark. It's not surrealistic like your last novel was, but there are moments.
Well, when we are grieving, life doesn't make sense the way sometimes we pretend it does when we're not grieving. Grief is a state in which, that's one of the things Janine thinks is, in many cultures, people rub pitch on their body, or they wear black, or they're allowed to walk around in a way that everybody sees they're not the same as you and me right now. They're in a different place. In our culture, if somebody's grieving, they're supposed to look and act the same way as everybody else, but it's a little bit of a charade. And she tries that for a while. And once she leaves to get to this cabin, her consciousness becomes a little ecstatic, is the way I think of it. There's a bit of ecstasy mixed with the depression. So she's not only depressed in the way that a person is after a loss like this, in the sense that she doesn't take care of herself, she doesn't take care of her cabin, everything's a mess, she's unable to follow through on anything. But there's also these moments of ecstasy in which she sees the world in a brilliant and exciting way. And she also is visited by visions of her loved one, and it comes in seeing him walk away across a field or seeing him in the face of the bear, and convincing herself at one point that it's him knocking at the door. And I think that that's not an uncommon thing for somebody in her state of having recently lost somebody who she's lived with for 25 years.
You're listening to The Right Question, I'm Cherie Newman talking with David Allen Cates about his novel Tom Connor's Gift. You can hear this program online. There's audio posted at our blog, mtpr.org/twq, and there's also a link on our Facebook page. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. Don't go away. Let's talk about this place called the Rocky Mountain Front. It's windy, it's huge, and so you put this woman in this small cabin, but she's surrounded by this hugeness.
The choices you make when you write a book, you make a lot of choices, and some of them work and some of them don't. And all of my work has been not because I've consciously decided I wanted to write books like this, but for whatever weird thing is in my brain that makes me want to write books, all of my characters have been exiled characters, characters away from home, characters that are off in the great wide open trying to get their legs under them. That's one way of saying it. And so for somebody like me who has written about exiled characters, this was a pretty good place to exile somebody. So it worked. That's the best way I usually describe things. I make a lot of choices that don't work, and when I got going on this, I just felt like I can write this novel, and all of the physical things, the bear, the canyon, the wind, the sky, the land, served to illuminate her situation and force a movement ultimately in her situation.
Tom Connor's gift was given in love, but as a young woman, Janine didn't recognize that love. And don't you think that happens a lot with people, that we don't recognize actual love when it's right in front of us because we're so busy comparing what happens to us to somebody else's story? Does that make sense as a question?
Yes, it makes a lot of sense. I think that one of the wonderful things about being alive, and certainly what one of the wonderful things about a good story, is that it makes the world bigger than we thought it was. When our world gets smaller, I think that's when despair comes in. But when life surprises us and we're suddenly able to recognize, oh, that too is love. The world is suddenly a little larger. There's more space. And I think great stories, and actually in all of our lives as well, we have these moments, not like an epiphany, but we have these periods in our life that we come to understand something we didn't understand before, and it makes our world bigger. I always think that a great book has to make the reader at the end of it think, oh, that is also in the world. That is something I didn't see before that makes my world bigger. And certainly Janine at this point in her life is capable of seeing beyond the limits of what her world was in her other life when she was married and Mark was still alive. Now she's exposed, she's in pain, but the letters illuminate a part of the universe that before that she had been blind to. There's a whole part about blind spots in this book. That's the light that she's capable of seeing at the end.
In one of the letters, Tom writes, "The place of absolute mystery is the place we need to go to understand," which is something I had to think about for a little bit. What does he mean by that?
Yeah, well, I think Tom is he's a searcher. He's in the most simplest explanation, he's trying to process his own pains and losses. But he's also trying to process and understand what it is to be a human being, what the purpose of his life is. As we all have, and this is something I've probably said every time you've interviewed me, the universal thing that binds us, the universal experience of human beings is we're going to die and we suffer. And so given those two givens, how do we find meaning and dignity in our lives? And with Tom and with all of us, we have to find that meaning. We have to figure out what it is that gives our life meaning despite these certainties of suffering and death. And Tom's is in pushing himself, putting himself out there in a way that allows him, as he interprets it, to step up right to the edge of the cliff and look down into what he calls the abyss. And he thinks that by going there, he will understand the meaning of his life. And so he's always pushing to get to that spot. That's the push of his own tragic arc, is that attempt to get to the edge of the cliff and look down into the great unknown.
And most of this looking into the great unknown is happening in Central America.
It's happening in Central America. So in this novel, there's a 320, 30 pages or something. About 80 of the pages are Tom in Central America, and at a time when there was a lot of war in Central America. And Tom works as a kind of a freelance stringer, but he's also trying to write fiction. But he's right in the middle of a lot of some troubling situations, and he's very exposed. He never has any money. He's always staying in the worst places in the worst parts of town, and he's a kind of a like a French poet from the 19th century or something, you know, or Henry Miller kind of. He's living in squalor, and he's doing it with enthusiasm and gusto, and yet he's also doing it with a purpose of trying to, I mean, he doesn't really have any other options for one thing, so it's not like he's chosen just to live this way for the sake of it, but he's, you know, we have a long literary history of people writers who've lived in squalor in slums and tried to expose themselves to the world like he does.
Called the starving artist syndrome, I believe.
Yeah, and it has a basis in fact, let me tell you.
As you mentioned, Tom is trying to put meaning into the world through his writing. And he's living this unusual life, unusual compared to Janine, who's a physician in the United States. And after a while, he quits. He just finds it too difficult, I guess, to clarify the world through writing. Mm-hmm. Is that something that's ever occurred to you?
Oh, more times than you could count. No, I actually have quit numerous times for a year or so. Not just took a pause, but... Because I would say now I'm kind of in a pause. I finished this, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do next. But there have been times, certainly at least twice, where I said, you know, I've given this 20 years. I've given this, and it was too hard. It was too, there's no money in which I've just said I'm done. There's too many other things of interest in the world for me, but apparently there wasn't because I went back to writing. Tom, though, is a heavy drinker, and by the time he reaches his mid-30s, he's lost what he calls his glow. He doesn't have whatever it was he had before, and he recognizes that, and he thinks that if he's going to make any meaning of his life now, he's got to do it in some other way. So... he decides he's going to stop writing and come back to the States and try to get involved in some kind of business. It doesn't work for him. He's not he is what he is. The way he's lived is the amount he's drank, the way he's stayed on the edge has kind of already locked in his tragic arc. And he's so, I haven't been there.
Oh, good. That sounds like a pretty self-destructive place to be.
Yeah.
What else would you like to say about the book? Is there anything I haven't asked you that you are burning to say about Tom Carner's gift?
Well, you know, I can say this. This is my sixth novel, my fifth published novel, and the other one that's not published is a good book. It's not a practice book. It's just one that hasn't found a publisher or may never, I haven't sent it out for a while. And every time I finished a book, I've had a sense of being empty, of having felt as though I've fulfilled an ambition and not had a lot of ambition in me anymore. I've had a sense of fatigue. But this one, and I don't know if it's because of my age, I'm 58, I have that, but it's much stronger. I feel like I've used up all my ambition. I don't have anything I can do better than this. I don't have anything else to say, at least not in novel form. I don't know if that's true, but I'm more tired. I'm more emptied out. I feel like a hollow person and a tired person after finishing this book. It was very, very hard. And like I say, I'm just trying to embrace the emptiness and see what happens. I'm not depressed, but it is an odd thing at my stage in my life, being as ambitious and driven as I've been since I've been 20, to feel as unambitious and like I don't care what happens. I don't care what I write. I've done as well as I could over 35 years, and that gives me a sense of joy. But at the same time, I have a little bit of worry because I used to, we had kids in the house for 28 years, and a lot of the choices I made about whether I'm going to do this or do that had to do with my ambition and my children. And now the children are gone, and I have no ambition, so I'm not sure what I'm going to do now. But I'm, like I say, I'm not depressed.
I'm not surprised that you feel empty because you poured your entire life and a few other people's lives into this book. It is so full of not only story, but just general life wisdom through the characters looking back at their lives and through Janine's stream of consciousness. So mm-hmm. I'm not surprised that you've emptied yourself out. But I will remind you of that the next time we do one of these interviews.
Good.
I'll remind you that you said you were all empty.
Yeah, well, nature doesn't like a vacuum, so I've just been trying to hold and see what happens. My wife keeps saying, embrace the emptiness, embrace the emptiness.
It feels strange, though.
Yes, it feels very strange, yeah.
It's something we're not used to when it occurs.
Yeah.
David Allen Cates lives in Missoula, Montana. The title of his novel is Tom Carner's Gift. You can listen to this program again and find more information about David Allen Cates and his many novels at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Links to that information are also on our Facebook page. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman. Wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.